not that surprising. We know that the CIA has operations all over the world. This has some specific information about a facility in Frankfurt that looks to have been focused on, well, it's not clear what it was focused on. The information talks about spying on Iran, which is, again, where they spy on Iran, the little bit news that that it's this place in Frankfurt. The fact that CIA has listening, you know, spots scattered around the world in secret locations itself isn't news, but I think the Germans are rightly concerned. I don't think it's it should be comfortable for them that the CIA is engaging in spying. I suspect not just in not just on Iran, but on Germany itself.
And Cindy, we just have 10 seconds, but Julian Assange now saying he'll share the code with tech companies so they can close their vulnerabilities.
That's good news. That's good news. And the CIA should have done it a long time ago. The idea that the CIA knew about this problem, that this information got out of their control last year and doesn't appear to have told the tech companies is, I think, shameful. And people need to really turn to the CIA and ask them why aren't they standing with tech companies and with the American people and people around the world to have secure products?
Cindy
That's
Cohen,
where their interest should be.
We want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project annual benefit show on Friday, March 10th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is a forest defense organization that has been successfully defending eastern Oregon forests for the last 25 years against ecological destruction. This benefit features music by A Stick, A Stone, Cinder Well, and Johanna Warren, as well as humor, storytelling, and more. Again, that's the Blue Mountain Biodiversity Project annual benefit show on Friday, March 10th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Action Plan, Immigration Rights, on Sunday, March 19th at the Concordia University Library in Portland. Oregon Action Plan is a series of events to inform and empower our community. This first event will focus on immigration in Oregon. How is what's happening on the national level affecting people in Oregon? What are organizations doing to support and protect their communities? And what can allies do to be effective and supportive? Again, that's Oregon Action Plan, Immigration Rights, on Sunday, March 19th at the Concordia University Library, 2800 Northeast Liberty Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioner Amanda Fritz held a listening session with critics this morning.
Two defendants have been found guilty of conspiracy in the Malheur Wildlife Refuge takeover.
Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer has introduced the No Trump Bill in the House of Representatives.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 10th, 2017, the 50th day of the Trumpocalypse. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterland. Earlier today, a federal jury found two of four defendants guilty of conspiracy in the 41-day takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The jury deliberated for 3 days at the end of a 10-day trial before U.S. District Judge Anna Brown. Defendants Jason Patrick and Daryl Thorne were found guilty of conspiring to prevent federal workers from doing their jobs through intimidation, threat, or force. Patrick was identified as one of the organizers and Thorne as a provider of security. Thorne was also found guilty of possessing a firearm in a federal facility. Two other men, Dwayne Emmer and Jake Ryan, had also been charged but were found not guilty of the conspiracy charge. But the jury did find both Emmer and Ryan guilty of depredation of government property. The two were identified as having willfully damaged the refuge by using construction equipment found at the refuge to dig two deep trenches. The guilty verdicts following the surprise October acquittals of Amon Bundy and six co-defendants on the same charges. Many felt that the first trial was an example of prosecutorial overreach and that this time they narrowed their scope and anticipated where the defense pushback would come from.
After months of outbursts and demonstrations during city council meetings, Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioner Amanda Fritz held a listening session with critics this morning. After the meeting, Wheeler said that a number of good ideas had been put forward by the audience. The mayor's staff later cautioned that some of the rule changes may be a challenge to implement because they could require a change to the city charter. Wheeler expressed an interest in expanding the opportunity for public comment at the beginning of city council meetings and said he would look into increasing the number of slots from 5 to 10. He also expressed interest in allowing citizens same-day sign-up for public comment and the possibility of scheduling additional listening sessions on days with a light city council agenda.
Residents of the Kenton neighborhood in North Portland have approved a tiny house community for homeless women. The residents of the neighborhood voted 178-75 to allow a village of 14 of the tiny structures. The community will sit on Portland Development Commission-owned land and will be for women transitioning out of homelessness. City officials backed the pilot project to form a community with shared restrooms, common space, and a garden at a site off North Argyle Street near Kenton Park. The tiny houses, which were designed by students at Portland State University, measure less than 8 by 12 feet and are intended more as sleeping pods with storage space than a home to build a life in. Catholic Charities will manage the village, providing support on-site and through social workers who will help each woman navigate her way to permanent housing.
Yesterday, Oregon Democrat Earl Blumenauer introduced a bill entitled the No Trump Act in the U.S. House of Representatives. The catchy acronym is derived from the bill's full title, the No Taxpayer Revenue Used to Monetize the Presidency Act. The bill would prohibit the use of taxpayer dollars to pay for any expenses incurred at a hotel or other property owned by the president or any of his relatives. Blumenauer said that he has long had a concern about the president's unwillingness to divest his ownership position in the Trump Organization. He was particularly concerned with recent reports of tax dollars paying for Secret Service and embassy officials to travel with Trump's children on a business trip, and as government officials spend time at Trump facilities. Despite the fact that the obvious target is the current president, if the bill passed, it would apply to all future presidents. However, the odds of that happening are not good. The bill would need to be passed by both houses of Congress and then signed by the president. All are under Republican control, and one is named in the bill's title.
Washington Senator Patty Murray, the top Democrat on the Health, Labor, Education, and Pensions Committee, has called the proposed American Health Care Act a, quote, slap in the face to women, end quote. The legislation introduced earlier this week would roll back many of the provisions and protections currently provided under the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. The new law would place restrictions on women seeking abortions, prenatal care, contraception, and cancer screenings. Republicans are hoping to rush the legislation through the House of Representatives despite the unified opposition of Democrats as well as powerful lobbying groups such as the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, the American Nurses Association, and AARP. While the bill is seen as having a chance to clear the House, its future in the Senate is much less certain. Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine have both come out against the bill's limitations around Planned Parenthood funding. And Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, has repeatedly tweeted that the current bill lacks the support it would need to pass the Senate.
Seven states have joined forces to challenge the Trump administration ban on travel to the U.S. from six primarily Muslim countries. The states are Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New York, Oregon, and Washington. Others are expected to follow. Hawaii and New York focus on the anti-Muslim discriminatory nature of the ban, while Washington, Oregon, and others cite the economic consequences of limiting travel by residents and tourists, as well as prospective students, employees, or healthcare recipients. Trump's original ban was more expansive, including seven nations, and had more restrictive visa and travel guidelines. That ban was blocked by a federal judge in Washington state. The new ban is narrower in scope and is currently scheduled to go into effect on March 16th. The White House is said to be very confident that this version will hold up in court, but that has not stopped the states from suing to block it.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for periods of rain with temperatures reaching the mid-50s. East of the Cascades in Hood River, you can expect similar conditions. And don't forget that daylight savings time returns this weekend. Remember to move your clocks ahead 1 hour when you go to bed on Saturday night. On this date in 1876, the first telephone call was made when Alexander Graham Bell transmitted the words, "Mr. Watson, come here, I want to see you," to his assistant Thomas A. Watson, who was in the next room next door. The quote of the day is from the American writer and satirist Ambrose Bierce, who said in 1911, quote, "The telephone is an invention of the devil, which abrogates some of the advantages of making a disagreeable person keep his distance."
Now here's KBOO's Ray Bodwell with a review and commentary on this week's fabrications from the Trump administration.
On Saturday, in a series of totally unsubstantiated tweets, Donald Trump accused the Obama administration and the former president himself of tapping Trump Tower phones during the run-up to the November election. Obama administration officials quickly denied the allegations and pointed out that it is illegal for the president to initiate a wiretap, noting that a court order is required. Despite that denial and Mr. Trump's long history of fabrications, Presidential Advisor Kellyanne Conway, Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and noted political gadfly Newt Gingrich took to the Sunday airwaves to defend the president's ravings and reinforce his demand for a congressional investigation.
You have various incredible news sources showing that there was politically motivated activity all during the campaign and suggesting that there may be more there. He's the president of the United States. He has information and intelligence that the rest of us do not.
I think he firmly believes that this is a storyline that has been reported pretty widely by quite a few outlets.
It's very unlikely that the FBI happened to go in October to ask for a wiretap and got it from the FISA court with nobody in the Obama White House knowing they were doing it. And all this stuff smells to high heaven despite the best efforts of the elite media to cover it up.
The credible news source that both Conway and Sanders were referencing turns out to be syndicated conservative commentator Mark Levin. Levin's comments, which were unsupported by evidence of any kind, were picked up and replayed by Breitbart News and Heat Street. Heat Street, in case you haven't heard of it, is a relatively new conservative/libertarian website that is owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. After hearing of the tweets, FBI Director James Comey jumped into the fray, claiming that the president's accusations were false and urging the Justice Department to publicly refute the president. Soon thereafter, former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper publicly stated that there had been no wiretap, and even California Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, a member of Trump's transition team and the current chairman of the House Select Committee on Intelligence, managed to sound skeptical.
There was no wiretap against Trump Tower during the campaign conducted by any part of the national intelligence community. None at all.
I mean, I have not seen that evidence. As you know, I think that a lot of that was maybe a little bit, the multiple tweets were perhaps a little bit strung together.
So why does any of this even matter? Isn't this just another example of Trump's itchy Twitter finger going on another unfounded rampage, 140 characters at a time? It matters because while the media hysteria about a possible illegal wiretap initiated by the previous administration was going on, Congress and the minions of the current administration were systematically taking apart our government. Here's some of what happened over those 5 days. A revised travel ban was introduced targeting 6 primarily Muslim countries. Reacting to new guidelines from the Trump administration, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a critical case on transgender rights. A 25% budget cut was announced for the EPA, taking it back to the funding level of 1991. Scott Pruitt, the new EPA administrator, publicly stated that climate change is not affected by carbon dioxide levels. It was announced that the telecommunications giants, like Verizon and AT&T, will not have to take reasonable measures to ensure that their customers' personal information is not stolen or accidentally released. The Republican Congress introduced the new American Health Care Act, which has the potential to strip 15 million Americans of health insurance while providing a massive tax cut for the wealthy. The Senate voted to kill the Fair Pay and Safe Workplace rule, which was introduced during the Obama administration to punish companies that don't divulge wage or safety violations by prohibiting them from bidding on government contracts. It was overturned on a party-line vote under the Congressional Review Act, which means it cannot be reintroduced in the future. These are just some of the atrocities the Republican administration and Congress perpetrated while much of the mainstream media were on a wild goose chase over the bogus wiretapping allegations. Of course, because he is the president, at any time Mr. Trump could have gotten the answer as to whether or not he had been wiretapped by simply calling up the Department of Justice and asking if it were true. He's the president. He's their boss. He has that right. But he never did. Instead, he just let the country chase that wild goose while his hatchet men and women continued to knock the supports out from under our society. Mr. Trump may have a fifth-grade vocabulary, but as Steve Bannon has pointed out in the past, Trump is the master of the head fake. And as a country, we need to recognize this and learn how to defend ourselves before he and his Republican Congress and his cabinet of billionaires steal everything that we have. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Representatives of Native American nations and tribes are in Washington, D.C. today as part of a series of actions to put indigenous issues on the national political agenda. Standing Rock Sioux leaders led a prayer march Friday morning while drawing attention to the intersection of indigenous sovereignty rights and environmental protection. Meanwhile, indigenous activists and their allies are marching in Los Angeles to call on the city council to cut financial ties with Wells Fargo over the bank's financing of the Dakota Access Pipeline project. So far, three cities have taken divestment actions: Seattle, Santa Monica, and Davis, California. Victoria Tali Corpus, a UN representative who focuses on indigenous issues around the world, just spent 2 weeks in the United States visiting Native American tribes. Jim Kent spoke with Corpus about what she plans to file in her official report.
What was your main purpose for going to that area in North Dakota?
Well, I was invited here to the United States, actually, upon the request of Chairman David Archambault. I met him in Geneva last July of 2016, and he invited me to come, but I told him that I can only come if it will be upon the invitation of the U.S. government, because if I do an official country visit, I can make a report about what I have seen, which will be submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council. So I got the invitation from the U.S. government, and of course, one of the key areas that I will visit will be the Standing Rock Sioux, because that has been an issue that has been going on for a year almost, and it's important to see what the situation is like there.
Could you tell me, what were your impressions from what was taking place up there at Standing Rock with regards to that pipeline going through?
Well, I think that for me, I find it very unfortunate that the consultations have not been done with the tribes in Standing Rock Sioux, and even the environmental impact assessment that was made by the Army Corps of Engineers didn't reflect the concerns of the tribes, especially in relation to how their sacred places and cultural sites are going to be adversely affected by the pipeline. So I think that it's bad that no adequate or meaningful consultation has been done with them, and in fact they will be directly affected by whatever the pipeline is going to bring in, you know, whether this will be leaks or even the imposition of this pipeline over their sacred sites. You know, their cultural integrity and autonomy will be adversely impacted as well.
Now, Lakota people that I've spoken to, what initially was brought up and remained a concern was the fact that this pipeline was the first place it was supposed to be put across was Bismarck, predominantly white location that was going to be impacted. And when they complained about it, it was suddenly moved south to be not interfering with them at all, but then interfering with the tribal people. Were you aware of that, and can you comment on that?
Yes, yes, I was aware of that. In fact, I spoke as well with the governor of North Dakota, and I raised this question, this issue myself. And I think that it's really not, you know, it's very discriminatory, you know, to agree immediately when the white people are complaining, but even without consulting the tribes, they just decided to put a pipeline under their sacred sites, you know, in the river which is the source of their drinking and irrigation waters. So I think that really is symbolic of what the kind of discrimination is against indigenous people.
In the Associated Press piece, they brought up the concern that you had expressed, presumably, that you felt, and this was a big issue here among many people, Native and non, the use of force against the protesters. Would you want to comment on that?
Yes, well, I did see the videos of how the protesters have been treated, you know, and I thought that there was really an excessive use of force, which is not commensurate with the kinds of protests that they are doing. You know, I mean, there has not been really serious incidents of violence from the side of the water protectors, and yet the kind of police operations against them were really overkill, you know, in terms of people being fired with water cannons, rubber bullets, dogs biting them, and them being placed in like dog kennels. I think these are all, you know, uncalled for, and that's not the way to deal with a peaceful protest.
And in spite of that, I don't know whether it was after you made that statement or before, but the North Dakota governor said he felt that the law enforcement used great professionalism and restraint.
Yeah, well, I really don't know if that's restraint. You know, I think that, you know, I'm also I have also been engaged in these kinds of mass rallies against some issues in the Philippines, and if ever you are, I've never experienced being shot by a rubber bullet. I think that's really very dangerous, you know, and of course water cannons in a situation where the temperature is freezing is also very dangerous. So I think those are not, that's not a restraint, that's just, for me, it's really, it's excessive. And the situation doesn't warrant those kinds of actions and equipment, you know, use against the water protectors.
Now, so you've been here, you visited with these people. Now, what happens with regard to your visit here? You make a report, and what happens?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, the executive order which allows for the continuation of the pipeline, you know, and without even conducting an environmental impact study, I hope that will be revisited and reviewed, because the protests are still there. The issues that the people are laying down are still valid, you know, and if the pipeline is completed, you know, without taking into account those concerns raised by the indigenous peoples and others, then that's very unfortunate. So I hope that my report will, you know, it will influence somehow the decisions being taken by the government. But the other thing is, I hope that the indigenous peoples will be able to use the recommendations that will come out from my report to also strengthen their own assertion of their rights. I know that the United States government might not give any value to it. If the U.S. has that position, then it's moral authority in terms of saying that other countries don't respect human rights, etc., will also be significantly diminished, because if they cannot even apply those international human rights standards in their own country, what right do they have to be saying or criticizing other countries doing similar things?
Victoria Tauli-Corpos is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. She spoke with me at the conclusion of a recent mission to the United States at the request of Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman David Archambault. For FSRN, I'm Jim Kent.
And now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. More than 11 million jobs would be created over 10 years if Congress approved a $1 trillion U.S. infrastructure rebuild. That's according to a study from Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce. The report says it would at least temporarily revive America's blue-collar economy, because more than half of the new jobs would go to high school-educated and college dropout workers. According to the report, if the Senate Democratic infrastructure plan were adopted, it would create even more jobs, 15 million over 10 years. Historically, more jobs have been created in the U.S. under Democratic presidents than under Republicans.
Good afternoon, Mississippi! Are you fired up? Are you ready to go?
United Auto Workers President Dennis Williams. Canton, Mississippi Nissan workers, supported by the United Auto Workers, the NAACP, Senator Bernie Sanders, and activist actor Danny Glover, held a spirited March on Mississippi over the weekend in Canton. The message was that worker rights are human rights. Nissan workers want a union, and they want to be able to vote for a union free of fear and intimidation from Nissan.
Brothers and sisters, friends all, it is your moment, your time in history. You will determine not only the fate of this facility here, but you will send a signal to workers everywhere. It's time to rise up. It's time to join together. It's time to change things.
Saru Jeremon is with ROC, the Restaurant Opportunities Center. Jeremon says that resistance to Trump and violence against women are part of why women are rising in protest, but worker issues are also motivating the protests.
$15 minimum wage for everybody, including tip restaurant workers who are in large majority women and who suffer from the highest levels of sexual harassment of any workers in the U.S. because they have to rely on tip to support their families. We are rising for paid sick days and paid family leave for every worker in America. Protections against sexual harassment and discrimination based on race and gender and religion.
The National Black Worker Center Project is launching a hashtag Working While Black campaign advocating a new deal for Black America. Executive Director Tanya Wallace Goburn says to Trump and members of Congress that they should bring an end to the economic abuses of Black workers with a vision that goes beyond the desire for political power.
Rather than focusing on filling the pockets and wallets of billionaires, we need to focus on building projects that don't extract wealth from our communities and builds wealth within our communities. And that's something that all of us, no matter what your race or ethnicity is, can align with.
The hashtag Working While Black campaign will expose the impacts of racial and economic injustice in the workplace through workers telling their stories.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News provided by Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. The producer of tonight's newscast is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zelos Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Keenan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Cecil and Celeste take your calls. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein holds a weekly conversation about our place on the planet. At 11 on Health Watch, Ellen Goldsmith talks to Peggy Orenstein, author of the New York Times bestseller, Girls and Sex, about the generation gap that has emerged between parents and their daughters. And at 11:30, Between the Lines Radio brings you a roundup of the week's underreported stories. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6, and have a great weekend. Good night, Linda, Jenna.
Good night, Liam, Jenna.
Night. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Nonesuch Records, now featuring the Magnetic Fields 50-Song Memoir, an album that chronicles the 50 years of songwriter Stephen Merritt's life with one song per year. The Magnetic Fields 50-Song Memoir is available now. And now, Rose City Hip Hop.
We got DPD in the building, Deaf on Dummies.
How y'all doing, everybody?
Yeah.
How about y'all go ahead and introduce yourself?
My name is Dove. I'm the more pale one of the group. I'm Lithuanian Cuban. I'm out here repping DPD to the end of me.
My name is Kalo Day. I'm originally from Eugene, Oregon. I'm just coming up here in Vancouver for like the last 4 years. And